Harry was a Renaissance man, a man of letters, whose constant stand on behalf of Anatoly Babakov had captured the public's imagination. Bob, on the other hand, was a man of business, of balance sheets, who only ever read a book when he was on holiday. Perhaps it was simply the game of cricket that brought the two men together, except on those occasions when Gloucestershire played Yorkshire. Bob turned his attention to a paper that was to be presented by Sebastian, setting out why he felt the company shouldn't be investing in a new luxury liner at the present time.
"Major Fisher," intoned the butler, before closing the door.
"Alex, it's good to see you again," said Virginia as she poured him a double gin and tonic. "I do hope things are going well for you."
"Up and down, like Tower Bridge, said Alex, as she passed him his drink, all too aware that Lady Virginia only ever invited him to visit her when she wanted something. Not that he could complain. He wasn't exactly flush since he'd lost his place on the board of Barrington's. Virginia wasted no time coming to the point.
"Do you recall our successful little sortie with Bob Bingham a couple of years ago?"
"Could I ever forget?" said Alex. "Mind you, it's not something I'd ever want to repeat," he added quickly.
"No, that wasn't what I had in mind. But I do need you to do a little digging for me. I'd like to know how much Bingham is worth. His company, his shareholdings, properties, particularly the properties, and any other source of income he may have that he wouldn't want the taxman to know about. Dig deep and spare no details, however insignificant they might seem. And you'll be paid £5 an hour plus expenses, and a bonus of £25 if I'm satisfied with your work."
Alex smiled. Virginia had never once in the past paid the promised bonus, and her idea of expenses were to travel third class and not stay overnight. But given his present circumstances, he wasn't able to scoff at £5 an hour.
"When do you need my report?" "In 10 days' time, Alex. And then I may well have another job for you, nearer home."
Virginia had planned Priscilla Bingham's visit to London with military precision. Nothing was left to chance. On the Monday, the two of them were driven to Epsom, where they joined Lord Malmesbury in his private box on the finishing line. Priscilla clearly enjoyed having a badge for the Royal Enclosure, where several men complimented her on her Hartnell outfit and Jackie Kennedy pillbox hat. She hadn't received so much attention in years. On Tuesday, following a light lunch at Simpson's, they dropped into a drinks reception at the banqueting house before going on to a gala dinner at the Savoy in aid of the Red Cross, where Matt Munro serenaded the guests. On Wednesday, it was the turn of the Queen's Club, where they watched a polo match between a Windsor team captained by the young Prince Charles and a visiting Argentinian side, most of whom Priscilla couldn't take her eyes off. In the evening, they had house seats for Funny Girl, a new musical with its original Broadway star, Barbara Streisand, which had queues for returns that were the envy of every other West End theatre. On Thursday, and heaven knows how Virginia fixed the tickets, they attended a royal garden party at Buckingham Palace, where Priscilla was presented to Princess Alexandra. In the evening, they dined with the Duke of Bridgewater and his eldest son, Boffy, who couldn't take his eyes off Priscilla. In fact, Virginia had to warn him that despite her encouragement, he just might be overdoing it. On Friday, Priscilla was so exhausted she spent the morning in bed and was only just up in time to keep an appointment with her hairdresser before going on in the evening to Covent Garden to see a production of Giselle. On Saturday morning, they attended Trooping the Colour, watching the ceremony from the Scottish office overlooking Horse Guards. In the evening, they had a quiet supper à deux at Virginia's flat.
"No one in London would dream of venturing out on a Saturday night," she explained. "The streets are full of foreigners and visiting football hooligans."
But then Virginia had always intended to use that night to sow the first seeds of doubt in her friend's mind.
"What a week," said Priscilla, as they sat down for supper. "What fun. And to think that tomorrow I have to go back to Mablethorpe."
"You don't have to go back," said Virginia.
Oh, but Robert is expecting me.
Is he? Frankly, would he even notice if you were to spend a few more days in London?
Priscilla put down her knife and fork, clearly considering the proposition. In truth, Virginia didn't want her to remain in London a day longer, as she was exhausted and had nothing planned for the following week.
Have you ever thought about leaving, Robert?
Asked Virginia, as Morton refilled Priscilla's wine glass.
Regularly. But how could I possibly survive without him?
Rather well, I suspect. After all, you have a lovely home in the Boltons, not to mention...
But it's not mine.
It could be, said Virginia, warming to her task.
What do you mean?
Did you read that article about Robert in the business section of the Telegraph a couple of weeks ago?
I never read the business section of any paper.
Well, it was most illuminating. It seems that Bingham's fish paste is valued at around 15 million, with no debts and healthy cash reserves.
But if I left Robert, I wouldn't want anything to do with the company.
You wouldn't have to have anything to do with it. Mablethorpe Hall, the Boltons, and your villa in the south of France, not to mention the 3 million sitting in the company's bank account, would still be less than 50% of what he's worth. And 50% is what you could expect after 26 years of marriage, and a son you virtually brought up on your own, because of all those hours your husband spent away from home pursuing his career.
How do you know there's 3 million in the company's account?
It's listed for anyone to see at company's house. 3,142,900 pounds, to be exact.
I had no idea.
Still, whatever you decide, my darling, I'll always be here to support you.
Even Virginia was surprised to receive a tearful call from Mablethorpe Hall on the following Friday.
I'm so lonely, Priscilla moaned. And there's just nothing for me to do up here.
Then why don't you come down to London and visit me for a few days, darling? Boffy Bridgewater was only asking me yesterday when you were expected back in town.
When Priscilla turned up on Virginia's doorstep the following afternoon, the first thing she said was,
Do you know a good divorce lawyer?
The best, Virginia replied. After all, she's acted for me on 2 occasions.
22 days later, Robert Bingham was served with the divorce writ. But Major Fisher still didn't get his bonus. Everyone rose as Mrs. Justice Havers entered the courtroom. The judge took her place and peered down at the 2 warring parties. She had read both submissions carefully, and after 1,000 divorces, knew exactly what she was looking for.
Mrs. Everett.
Priscilla's counsel immediately rose from her place.
My lady, she said, I understand that a settlement has been reached between the 2 parties, and I wonder if you'll be kind enough to outline the terms for me.
Certainly, my lady. In this case, I represent the plaintiff, Mrs. Priscilla Bingham, while my learned friend, Mr. Brooke, represents the defendant, Mr. Robert Bingham. My lady, Mrs. Bingham has been married to the defendant for the past 26 years. During that time, she has been a faithful, loyal, and dutiful wife. She bore a son, Clive, who, because of her husband's various business commitments, she had to raise virtually single-handed.
With the help of a nanny, a cook, a maid, and a cleaner, whispered Bob, which his counsel duly noted.
Even during the school holidays, my lady, it was rare for Mr. Bingham to spend more than a week with his wife and child, always wanting to get back to his factory in Grimsby. We are therefore proposing, continued learned counsel, that Mrs. Bingham should retain the family home in which she has lived for the past 26 years, along with the house in London and the villa near Cap Ferrat in the south of France, where she and her son always spent the long summer vacation together. Mrs. Bingham would also ask the court for the sum of £3 million in order that she can maintain the 3 houses, and continue to live in a style to which she has grown accustomed. I should point out, my lady, that this is far less than 50% of Mr. Bingham's considerable fortune.
Mrs. Everett sat down. And is Mr. Bingham agreeable to these terms, Mr. Brooke?
Robert's attorney rose slowly to his feet, tugged the lapels of his gown, and said,
Indeed, my lady. Mr. Bingham will retain the family company, Bingham's Fish Paste, which was founded by his grandfather over 100 years ago. He makes no other demands.
So be it, said the judge. But before final settlement is agreed, I always like both parties to confirm they are satisfied with the division, so there can be no recriminations at some later date, or any suggestion that they didn't fully understand what had been proposed. Mr. Bingham?
Robert's counsel nudged him, and Bob jumped up.
Are you satisfied with this division of your goods and chattels?
I am, my lady.
Thank you, Mr. Bingham.
Turning her attention to the other side of the courtroom, the judge asked Mrs. Bingham the same question. Priscilla rose to her feet, smiled up at the judge, and said,
I am satisfied. Indeed, I am happy for my ex-husband to select whichever of the two packages he would prefer.
How very magnanimous of you, declared the judge, as consternation appeared on the faces of both counsel, who had been quite unprepared for this unrehearsed intervention. Although it would surely make no difference to the outcome, counsel never likes to be taken by surprise.
Then I will put the question to Mr. Bingham once again, said the judge. But as it deserves careful consideration, I will allow Mr. Bingham to consider his position overnight. Court is adjourned until 10 a.m. tomorrow.
Bob was quickly on his feet.
That's most kind of you, my lady, but I have already made up.
Bob's counsel pulled him back down, because Mrs. Justice Havers had already left the court. If that was the first surprise of the day for Bob, the second was to see Sebastian Clifton sitting quietly at the back of the courtroom taking notes. He was even more surprised when Seb asked if he was free to join him for dinner.
Well, I'd planned to go back to Lincolnshire tonight, but now that I have to make a short reappearance in court tomorrow morning, I'd be delighted to take up your offer.
They both watched as Priscilla left the courtroom on Virginia's arm. She was sobbing quietly.
I could kill that woman, said Bob, and happily serve a life sentence.
I don't think that will be necessary, said Seb. I think I've come up with a far better solution for dealing with Lady Virginia.
At 10 o'clock the following morning, everyone was back in their places when Mrs. Justice Havers entered the courtroom. Once she had settled herself, she looked down at the counsel's bench and said,
Only one matter remains to be resolved, and that is which of the two packages Mr. Bingham has settled on.
Bob rose from his place.
I would like to thank you, my lady, for giving me the opportunity to reflect on my decision overnight, because I've decided to choose the three properties along with the £3 million. I'd like to thank my wife for her most magnanimous gesture and to wish her every success with running the company.
Uproar broke out in court. Apart from Bob Bingham, only two other people didn't look surprised: the judge and Sebastian Clifton. Chapter 16.
What possessed you to do something quite so stupid? Said Virginia.
I just wanted Robert to know how fair I considered the settlement was.
Well, that backfired spectacularly.
But I never thought for a moment he'd let go of his beloved company.
And I'm not convinced he has, said Virginia.
Those two are up to something. Those two?
Yes, I should have realized that Sebastian Clifton would have an ulterior motive for being in court. He may have taken me by surprise this time, but he won't get away with it again.
But he's only a child.
A child who is fast gaining a reputation in the city as a whiz kid. And never forget, he's the son of Emma and Harry Clifton, so he's not to be trusted.
But what's in it for him?
I haven't worked that out yet, but you can be sure he's after something. However, we can still stop them both in their tracks if we move quickly.
But what can I do now I'm penniless and homeless?
Pull yourself together, Priscilla. You own a company worth £15 million that only last year declared a profit of over £1 million.
But for how much longer? Now Robert's no longer around to manage it.
You needn't worry about that.
I know exactly the right person to take his place. He has considerable experience of mayor management, has served as the director of a public company, and, more important, he's available at short notice.
Sebastian, Bob and Clive Bingham met in Seb's office later that morning to discuss what needed to be done next.
The first part of our plan went smoothly enough, said Seb. But it won't be long before Virginia works out what we're up to. So we're going to have to move quickly, very quickly, if we're to get all the pieces off the chessboard in time.
Then I'll have to drive up to Grimsby this afternoon, said Bob.
It can't be too soon, said Seb, because you need to be back in London by tomorrow evening at the latest. I want everyone at Bingham's, from the management to the factory workers, and all of its customers up and down the country, to think the only reason you're visiting the factory is to say goodbye to the staff and wish them luck under the new management. Just before you leave, Clive will issue the press statement he's been working on.
Clive opened his briefcase and took out two sheets of foolscap paper.
The statement needs to be short, unequivocal, and to the point, he said, passing a copy to his father and Seb. I won't release it until I know Dad's on his way back to London, when I'll send a copy to the Grimsby Evening Telegraph. It's sure to make the front page. After that, I'll release it to every business correspondent in Fleet Street.
Bob read through the statement slowly and was impressed by what his son had come up with. However, he realised that a lot more needed to be done if the public, and not least Lady Virginia, were to believe he meant what he said.
And once I'm back in London, what do I do then?
Fly to Nice. Go straight to the house at Cap Ferrat and stay put, said Seb.
And after that? Asked Bob. I've never lasted more than a few days in the south of France before I was bored out of my mind and had to fly home.
Well, you're going to have to do a lot better than that, said Clive, if you're going to convince the world how much you're enjoying early retirement and that you have absolutely no interest in returning to Grimsby.
Mind you, most people won't find that too hard to believe, said Seb.
Retirement, said Bob, ignoring Seb's comment. I'll die rather than retire. And as for enjoying myself, I wasn't built for leisure, so perhaps you can tell me, Seb, how I'm supposed to pass the time of day.
Perhaps the occasional round of golf, followed by a long lunch at one of the many Michelin-starred restaurants along the Riviera, topped off by a visit to one of Nice's more exotic nightclubs.
And where will I find a pint of Bateman's and cotton chips served in newspaper?
I don't think you'll find too many fish and chip shops at Cap Ferrat, admitted Seb. And there's not much demand for mushy peas on the Riviera, added Clive.
The three of them burst out laughing.
I feel sorry for your mother, Clive, said Bob. She's about to discover just how close a friend Lady Virginia Fenwick really is.
Well, at least this time, Major, you'll be chairman of a company that doesn't have a board, or anyone else you have to answer to. You can start with a blank sheet of paper and set your own ground rules.
Possibly. But you will have noticed that the company's shares collapsed yesterday following Bingham's press statement.
What statement? Said Virginia.
Fisher picked up a copy of the Times from the coffee table and turned to the lead story in the business section. Virginia stared at a photograph of Bob shaking hands with some members of the factory staff following his farewell speech, then carefully read his statement.
Of course, I am sad to be leaving the company my grandfather founded in 1857, especially after serving as its chairman for the past 23 years. But I have no fear for the future of Bingham's while it's in the capable hands of my former wife, Priscilla. I hope everyone will continue to support her, as they have always supported me. However, it's time for me to retire to my beautiful home in the south of France and enjoy a well-earned rest.
I don't believe a word of it, said Virginia.
So the sooner you get yourself off to Grimsby, the better, Major. It's going to take all your skills and experience as an army officer to keep those people in their place.
When Clive drove his father to Heathrow later that evening, he couldn't get a word out of him.
What's the problem, Dad? He asked eventually.
Some of the staff were in tears when I left. People I've worked with for over 20 years. It took all my willpower not to roll up my sleeves and start loading the lorries.
I understand how you feel, Dad, but believe me, you've made the right decision.
I hope so, said Bob, as they came to a halt outside the terminal.
And don't forget, if you spot a photographer, just smile and look relaxed. We don't want the press thinking you're unhappy, because then Lady Virginia will work out exactly what we're up to.
I'll bet she already has.
Dad, we can beat her, as long as you don't lose your nerve.
Please make my imprisonment as short as possible, he pleaded after he'd checked his one bag in and given his son a hug.
I'll phone every day, said Clive, and bring you up to date with everything that's going on at this end.
And keep an eye on your mother. It's going to come as a dreadful shock when she meets up with the real Virginia for the first time.
By the time the Major stepped onto the platform at Grimsby Station, he knew exactly what needed to be done. His plan was foolproof, and his strategy honed to the finest detail. He already knew a great deal about Robert Bingham and the way he had run the company from the research he carried out for Lady Virginia. And on this occasion, she hadn't even tried to bargain with him. She had met all his demands. £20,000 a year plus expenses, including a suite of rooms at the Royal Hotel whenever he had to stay in Grimsby. Fisher felt there wasn't a moment to lose and instructed the taxi driver to take him straight to the factory. During the journey, he went over the speech he prepared, which wouldn't leave the workers in any doubt who was the boss. It shouldn't be too difficult to run a fish paste factory. After all, he commanded a company in Tobruk, with the Germans snapping at his heels. The taxi dropped him outside the factory. A scruffy man wearing a peaked cap, open-necked shirt and greasy overalls peered at the Major from the other side of the locked gates.
"What do you want?" he demanded.
"I'm Major Fisher, the new chairman of the company. Sir, open up immediately, my good man."
The man touched the peak of his cap and pulled the gate open.
"Where's the chairman's office?" demanded Fisher.
"Bob never had what you'd call an office, but management are at the top of those steps," the man said, pointing to the other side of the yard.
The Major marched across the yard, a little surprised by the lack of activity, because he knew the factory employed over 200 full-time workers, with another 100 part-time. He climbed the iron steps up to the first floor and pushed open the door to be greeted by a large open-plan office with a dozen desks, only two of which were occupied. A young man leapt to his feet.
"You must be Major Fisher," he said, as if he'd been expecting him.
"I'm Dave Perry, the assistant manager. I was told to show you around the factory and answer any questions you might have."
"I was rather hoping to have a meeting with the managing director, so I could be brought up to speed as quickly as possible." "Ah, you haven't heard?"
"Heard what?"
"Mr. Jopling handed in his notice yesterday. Told me that as he only had a couple of years before he retired, this might be a good time for someone else to fill his boots."
"And are you that someone else?" asked Fisher.
"Not on your Nelly," said Perry. "I've only been here a few months, and in any case, I don't fancy any more responsibility."
"Then it will have to be Pollock, the works manager," said Fisher. "Where's he?"
"Mr. Jopling sacked him yesterday for insubordination. It was almost the last decision he made before he resigned. Mind you, Steve Pollock can't complain. He's been sent home on full pay until the union completes its investigations. No one doubts that he'll be reinstated. The only trouble is, the committee usually takes a couple of months before they come to a decision."
"But he must have had a deputy," said Fisher, unable to hide his frustration.
"Yes, Les Simpkins. But he's on a time of motion course at Hull Poly. Waste of time and not a lot of motion, if you ask me."
Fisher strode across the room and looked down onto the factory floor.
"Why isn't the machinery working? Isn't this meant to be a 24-hour non-stop operation?"
he said, staring down at a dozen workers who were standing around, hands in pockets, idly chatting, while one of them rolled a cigarette.
"We usually work an 8-hour shift system," said Perry. "But you need a statutory number of qualified workers before the machinery can be turned on. Regulations, you understand. And unfortunately, an unusually large number of the lads are on sick leave this week."
The phone on his desk began to ring. He picked it up and listened for a moment.
I'm sorry to hear that, sir, but our new chairman has just arrived, so I'll pass you over to him.
Perry covered the mouthpiece and said,
It's the harbour master, Captain Borick. Seems to have a problem.
Good morning, Borick. It's Major Fisher, the chairman of the company. How can I help?
Good morning, Major. It's quite simple, really. You got 3 days' supply of cob piled up on my dockside, which I'd like picked up as soon as possible.
I'll get on to it straight away.
Thank you, Major, because if it hasn't been removed by 4 o'clock, I'll have no choice but to dump it back in the sea.
The phone went dead.
Where are the lorries that pick up the morning catch?
The drivers hung around until midday, but as no one had the authority to give the order for them to go to the harbour, they packed up for the day and went home.
You only missed them by a few minutes, Major. They'll be back at 6 tomorrow morning.
Bob was always here first thing. Like to go down to the docks and supervise the loading himself. That way he could be sure no one palmed him off with yesterday's catch.
Fisher slumped into a chair and stared at a pile of unopened letters addressed to Mr. Bingham.
Do I have a secretary by any chance?
He asked.
Val,
there's nothing she doesn't know about this place.
Fisher managed a weak smile.
So where is she?
On maternity leave, and not expected back for some months. But I know she put an ad in the Grimsby Evening Telegraph for a temp, he added, as a man who looked like a heavyweight boxer stomped into the room.
Which one are you's in charge?
He demanded. Perry pointed to the Major.
We need some help with the unloading, Gov.
Unloading what?
148 crates of fish paste jars. Same time every Tuesday. If you haven't got anyone to unload them, we'll have to take them back to Doncaster, and that'll cost you.
Perhaps you could give them a hand, Perry.
I'm management, Major. The unions would down tools if I so much as looked at a crate.
That was when Fisher realised that every one of them was singing from the same hymn sheet, and he wasn't the choir master. The Major lasted for 3 days, during which time not one pot of Bingham's fish paste left the factory. On balance, he decided that doing battle with the Germans in North Africa was far easier than trying to work with a bunch of bolshy shop stewards on Humberside. On Friday night, after the workers, all 200 of them, had collected their wage packets and gone home, the curtain finally came down. The Major checked out of the Humber Royal Hotel and took the last train back to London.
Bingham shares have fallen another 10%, said Seb.
What's the spot price? Asked Bob.
Seb checked the ticker tape machine in his office.
7 shillings and 6 pence. No, 7 shillings and 4 pence.
But they were £1 only a week ago.
I know, but that was before the Major beat a hasty retreat back to London.
Then it must be time for me to come back and sort the place out, said Bob.
Not quite yet, but be sure to have the number of a local travel agent handy.
So what am I expected to do in the meantime? Growled Bob.
Canasta?
Virginia and Priscilla had barely been on speaking terms for the past week, and a chance remark over breakfast started a row that had been simmering for some time.
Buffy Bridgewater was telling me last night that...
Buffy Bridgewater is a chinless wonder and a prize ass, snapped Priscilla,
who just happens to have a title and thousands of acres.
I'm not interested in his title, and before all this happened, I had thousands of acres.
And you still would have, said Virginia, if you hadn't made such a fool of yourself in court.
How was I to know Robert would be willing to let go of the company? I was simply trying to show how generous I thought he'd been. And now I don't even have a roof over my head.
Well, you can stay here for a little longer, said Virginia. But perhaps it might be wise to start looking for a place of your own. After all, I can hardly be expected to go on subsidising you forever.
But you said I could always rely on your support.
I don't remember saying always, said Virginia, as she dropped a slice of lemon in her tea.
Priscilla stood up, folded her napkin, and placed it on the table. She left the room without another word, walked upstairs to the guest bedroom, and began to pack.
Dad, you can catch the next plane home.
At last! But why now?
Mum's finally come to her senses.
She walked out of Lady Virginia's flat about an hour ago.
What makes you think she won't walk back in again?
Because she was lugging three suitcases and took a taxi to the Mulberry Hotel in Pimlico.
I'm on my way to the airport, said Bob.
Clive put the phone down.
Should I pick Dad up at Heathrow and drive him to the Mulberry?
I don't think so, said Seb. You'll only get in the way. Wait until he calls you.
Clive joined his mother and father later that evening for a drink at the Savoy.
So romantic, said Priscilla, who was holding Bob's hand. Your father has booked the same suite where we spent the first night of our honeymoon. But you'll be living in sin, mocked Clive. Not for long, said Priscilla. We're off to see Mrs. Justice Havers in the morning. Our counsel seems to think she can sort things out. I have a feeling her ladyship won't be all that surprised, said Clive.
When did you suddenly become so wise? Asked Bob.
When you left me with no choice but to stand on my own two feet.
There's a Mr. Bingham on the phone for you, said the switchboard operator.
Bob, are you still in London? Asked Seb. There's something I need to discuss with you.
No, I'm back in Grimsby, re-employing most of my staff. They seem to have enjoyed their extended holiday about as much as I did.
I see the share price is up a couple of pence.
Yes, but it will be some time before everything's up and running smoothly again. Perhaps you ought to buy a few shares while the price is so low.
I've been buying them for the past month, said Seb. I now own about 4% of Bingham's fish paste.
If I had a board, said Bob, I'd put you on it. However, I'm still in your debt, not least for your role as matchmaker. So why don't you send me a hefty bill for your professional services?
Now that we've vanquished Lady Virginia, I'd rather seek your advice on another problem I'm facing.
Virginia Fennett won't be vanquished until she's 6 foot under. But how can I help?
I want to take over Farthing's Bank and remove Adrian Sloane once and for all. But I can't hope to pull it off without your help.
You can't win them all, said Lady Virginia. But as Wellington reminded us after Waterloo, it's only the final battle that really matters.
And who's playing Napoleon on this particular battlefield?
None other than Emma Clifton.
And what will my role be?
Asked Fisher.
I need you to find out what really happened on the first night of the Buckingham's maiden voyage, because clearly the home fleet story was nothing more than a smokescreen. Priscilla Bingham overheard one of the directors telling her husband that if the truth ever got out, Emma Clifton would have to resign and the company might even go bankrupt. Nothing would suit me better, because that would leave our precious chairman with no choice but to settle the action and pay my costs.
Fisher remained silent for some time before he said,
There are a couple of directors on the board who've recently had a run-in with Mrs. Clifton, and one of them has a tendency to drink a little too much, especially when he's not paying. Do we have anything to offer him in return, should he decide to resign?
A place on the board of Farthing's Bank?
That would swing it. But what makes you think you can pull it off?
The chairman, Adrian Sloane, has every reason to loathe Sebastian Clifton and will do anything to bring him down.
How do you know that?
It's amazing what you can pick up at dinner parties, especially when your host thinks women couldn't possibly begin to understand what goes on in the city.
Giles Barrington, 1970. Chapter 17. Giles hadn't given a moment's thought to how he wanted to spend his 50th birthday, but Gwyneth had. Whenever Giles thought about his marriage, and he thought about it a great deal, he still couldn't pinpoint when things had begun to go wrong. The tragic death of their son Walter at the age of 3, and the realization that Gwyneth couldn't have another child, had turned her from a bright spirit who lit up everyone's lives to a melancholy shadow lost in her own world. Instead of the tragedy drawing them closer together, Giles found they were slowly drifting apart, not helped by a Member of Parliament's unsocial hours and then a minister's demanding schedule. Giles had hoped that time would prove a healer, but in truth they began to live separate lives, almost as if they weren't a couple, and he couldn't remember the last time they had made love. Despite this, he was determined to remain loyal to Gwyneth, as he didn't want a second divorce and still hoped they might be reconciled. Whenever they were together in public, they attempted to hide the truth, hoping Giles's constituents, his colleagues, and even their family wouldn't realize their marriage was a sham. But whenever Giles saw Harry and Emma together, he envied them. Giles had rather assumed that on his birthday, he'd be on his way to, or on his way back from, representing Her Majesty's government in some foreign field. Gwyneth, however, was insisting that the milestone should be properly celebrated.
"What do you have in mind?"
asked Giles.
"A dinner. Just the family and a few close friends."
"And where would it be held?"
"The House of Commons. We could book one of the private dining rooms." "That's the last place I want to be reminded that I'm 50. "Do try and remember, Giles, for most of us who don't go to the Palace of Westminster every day, it's still something rather special."
Giles knew when he was beaten, so invitations were sent out the following day, and when he looked around the dining room table 3 weeks later, it was clear that Gwyneth had been right, because everyone seemed to be enjoying themselves. Emma, who was seated on his right, and their sister Grace on his left, were chatting to their respective neighbours. Giles used the time to think about his speech, jotting down a note or two on the back of his menu.
"I know we shouldn't talk business on an occasion like this," said Emma to Ross Buchanan, "but you know how much I value your advice."
"And an old man," said Ross, "is always flattered by a young woman seeking his advice."
"I'll be 50 next year," Emma reminded him, "and you are an old flatterer."
"Who will be 70 next year?" said Ross. "Perhaps by then it will be time to put me out to grass, so while I'm still 69, how can I help?"
"I'm having trouble with Desmond Mellor."
"I never understood why you put him on the board in the first place."
"Force majeure," whispered Emma. "But now he's pushing for deputy chairman."
"Avoid it at all costs. He'll see it as nothing more than a stepping stone to the job he really wants."
"All the more reason to hold on until I think Sebastian is ready to take my place."
"Seb thinks he's ready to take your place right now," said Ross. "But if Mellor were to become your deputy, you'd spend your life looking over your shoulder. It's a golden rule for any chairman only ever to appoint a deputy who, one, isn't after your job, or two, has unquestionably been over-promoted, or three, is too old to take over from you."
"Good thinking," said Emma. "But there's not a lot I can do to stop him if he can convince a majority of the board to back him. To make matters worse, Seb thinks Mellor may have been in touch with Giles's first wife."
"Lady Virginia Fenwick," said Ross, spitting out the words.
"And possibly Alex Fisher as well."
"Then you'd better start looking over both shoulders."
"Now tell me, revered aunt," said Seb, "are you Chancellor of the University yet?"
"The Duke of Edinburgh is our Chancellor, as you well know," said Grace.
"Then what about Vice-Chancellor?"
"Not everyone is quite as ambitious as you, Seb. For some of us, doing a worthwhile job, however humble, is reward enough in itself."
"Then have you thought about principal of your college? After all, no one is more admired by their colleagues." "It's kind of you to say so, Sebastian, and I will tell you in confidence that when Dame Elizabeth retired from the post recently, I was approached by one or two people. However, I made it clear that I wasn't born to be an administrator, but a teacher, and am happy with my lot."
"I can't argue with that," said Seb.
"But tell me, Seb, as you're on your own tonight, should I assume there's still no one special in your life?"
"There hasn't been anyone special, Aunt Grace, since I was stupid enough to lose Samantha." I agree that wasn't your most glorious hour. I realised the first time I met her that she was an exceptional young woman. And on that particular subject, I speak with some authority.
You are right. I've never met anyone since who even comes close.
I'm sorry, Seb, it was tactless of me to raise the subject. But I'm sure, given time, you'll find someone.
I wish.
Are you still in touch with Samantha? Is there even the slightest chance?
Not a hope. I've written to her several times over the years, but she doesn't reply.
Have you thought of going over to America and admitting you were wrong?
Every day.
How's your campaign to have Anatoly Babakov released progressing? Asked Priscilla.
I fear progress may not be the right word, said Harry,
who was seated on the opposite side of the table from Giles.
Mind you, one can never be sure with the Soviets. One day you think they might be about to release him, but the next you're convinced they've thrown away the key.
Could anything happen to change that?
Change of leadership in the Kremlin might help. Someone who wants the world to know what Stalin was really like. But there's not much chance of that while Brezhnev is in power.
But he must know that we know that he knows.
He does, but he's just not willing to admit it to the outside world.
Does Babakov have a family?
His wife escaped from Russia just before he was arrested. She now lives in Pittsburgh. I've been in touch, and I'm hoping to visit her when I'm next in the States.
I hope you succeed, said Priscilla.
Please don't even think for a moment that we onlookers have forgotten about your campaign. Far from it, we are inspired by your example.
Thank you, said Harry.
You and Bob have been so supportive over the years.
Robert is a great admirer of your wife, as I'm sure you know. It just took me a little longer to appreciate why.
What's Bob up to now the company is flourishing again?
He's planning to build a new factory. It seems that most of his equipment belongs to the Stone Age.
That won't come cheap.
No, but I don't think he's got a lot of choice. Now it looks like we're about to join the common market.
I saw him having dinner in Bristol with Seb and Ross Buchanan.
Yes, they're plotting something, but I've only been able to piece together one or two clues. I was Detective Sergeant Warwick.
Detective Inspector Warwick,
Harry said, smiling.
Yes, of course, I remember. He was promoted in your last book. And no doubt Inspector Warwick would have found out what they were up to some time ago.
I may be able to add one or two nuggets of my own,
whispered Harry.
Then let's swap notes.
It's important to remember that Seb has never forgiven Adrian Sloane for appointing himself chairman on the day of Cedric Harcastle's funeral.
In Huddersfield, said Priscilla.
Yes, but why is that relevant?
Because I know Robert has taken the ferry across the Humber several times in the last couple of months.
Could he be visiting another woman who just happens to own 51% of Farthings?
Possibly, because Arnold Hardcastle recently stayed with us overnight, and apart from meals, he and Robert never came out of the study.
Then Adrian Sloane had better keep both his eyes wide open, because if Bob, Seb and Arnold are working together as a team, heaven help him, he said,
glancing across the table at Priscilla's husband.
Bingham's fish paste seems to have fallen out of the headlines lately,
said Gwyneth, turning to the chairman of the company.
And that's no bad thing, said Bob. Now we can get on with feeding the nation and not titillating the gossip columnists.
Gwyneth laughed.
I have a confession to make, she said. We've never had a jar of your fish paste in the house.
And I must confess I've never voted Labour, though I might if I lived in Bristol.
Gwyneth smiled.
What odds would you put on Giles holding on to his seat? Asked Bob.
Clinging on by his fingernails seems the likely outcome,
said Gwyneth.
Bristol Docklands has always been a marginal seat, but the opinion polls suggest that this time it's going to be too close to call. So a lot will depend on who the local Conservatives select as their candidate.
But Giles is a popular minister, much admired on both sides of the House. Doesn't that count for anything?
about 1,000 votes in Griff Haskins's opinion. But his constituency agent never stops reminding me that if the national swing is against you, there's not a lot you can do about it.
I suppose you have to come up to the Commons fairly regularly, said Jean Buchanan.
Not that often, actually, said Griff. We agents have a tendency to remain at the coalface, making sure the voters still love the member.
At that moment, the dining room door opened, and all conversation stopped as he entered the room.
No, no, please sit down. I didn't mean to interrupt,
declared a broad Yorkshire accent that hadn't been affected by several years as an Oxford don.
How kind of you to join us, Prime Minister, said Giles, leaping to his feet.
Only too delighted, said Harold Wilson. He gave me an excuse to escape for a few minutes from a dinner with the executive of the National Union of Mine Workers. Mind you, Giles, he added, looking around, I wouldn't be surprised if we were outnumbered by the Tories in this room. But not to worry. Griff will sort them out.
The Prime Minister leant across the table and shook hands with Giles's agent.
And who are these two delightful ladies?
My sisters, Emma and Grace, said Giles.
I bow before you both, said the Prime Minister. The first woman chairman of a public company and the renowned English scholar.
Grace blushed.
And if I'm not mistaken, he added, jabbing a finger across the table, that's Bob Bingham, the fish paste king. My mother always had a jar of your paste on the table for what she called high tea.
And at Downing Street? Inquired Bob.
We don't do high tea at Downing Street, said the Prime Minister, as he made his way slowly around the table, shaking hands and signing menus.
Giles was touched by how long the Prime Minister stayed, only leaving when a dutiful PPS reminded him that he was the guest of honour at the miners' dinner where he was due to make a speech. Just before he left, he took Harry to one side and whispered,
Thank you for your help in Moscow, Mr. Clifton. Don't think we've forgotten. And don't give up on Babakov, because we haven't.
Thank you, sir, said Harry.
And they all stood again as the Prime Minister left the room. After they'd resumed their seats, Jean Buchanan said to Griff,
It must be such fun being an old friend of the PM.
I've only met him once before, admitted Griff. But like an elephant, he never forgets, he added,
as Harry stood up, tapped the side of his wine glass with a spoon, and waited for silence.
Fellow guests, I invite you to join me in a toast to my oldest and dearest friend, the man who introduced me to his sister and his godfather to our son Sebastian. Will you rise and join me in a toast to the Right Honourable Sir Giles Barrington, Her Majesty's First Minister of State at the Foreign Office, and a man who still believes he should be the captain of the England cricket team?
Harry waited for the laughter to die down before he added,
And we all hope that Giles will retain his seat at the next election, and perhaps even fulfil his life's ambition and become Foreign Secretary.
Warm applause and cries of hear, hear echoed around the room as Giles rose to respond.
Thank you, Harry, and it's wonderful to have not only my family but my closest and dearest friends around me, who have come together for only one purpose, to remind me just how old I am. I've been blessed with a wonderful family and real friends, and surely any sensible man could wish for nothing more. However, many of you have been kind enough to ask me what I would like for my birthday.
Giles looked slowly around the table before saying,
To be Prime Minister, Foreign Secretary, and Chancellor of the Exchequer, all at the same time.
Laughter and applause broke out spontaneously before he added,
But for the moment, I'd be satisfied with holding on to Bristol Docklands at the next election.
Applause, but no laughter this time.
No, what I really want is for all of you here tonight to prosper and flourish,
Giles paused,
under a Labour government.
The jeers drowned the cheers, proving the Prime Minister to be right about Giles being outnumbered by Tories at his own birthday party.
So let me end by saying, if I don't win, I shall sulk.
The laughter returned.
A wise man once told me that the secret of a great speech is timing.
Giles smiled
and sat down, as everyone rose and gave him a standing ovation.
"So, where are you off to next?"
asked Emma, as the waiters returned to serve the guests with coffee and after-eight mince.
"East Berlin, a meeting of foreign ministers," replied her brother.
"Do you think they'll ever tear down that barbaric wall?"
asked Grace.
"Not as long as that stooge Albrecht is in power and simply carries out the bidding of his masters in the Kremlin."
"And closer to home," said Emma, "when do you think the general election will be?"
"Harold wants to go in May, when he's confident we can win."
"I feel sure you'll hold on to Bristol," said Emma, "barring some accident. But I still think the Tories will scrape home with a small majority."
"And you'll remain loyal to the Labour Party?"
Giles asked, turning to his younger sister.
"Of course," said Grace.
"And you, Emma?"
"Not a chance."
"Some things never change."
Chapter 18. Gwyneth groaned when the alarm went off, and didn't bother to check what time it was. She had perfected the art of falling back to sleep within minutes of Giles leaving the room. He always took a shower the night before and laid out the clothes he would need in his dressing room so he wouldn't have to turn on the light and disturb her. He glanced out of the window overlooking Smith Square. His car was already parked outside the front door. He didn't like to think what hour his driver had to get up to be sure he was never late. Once Giles had shaved and dressed, he went down to the kitchen, made himself a cup of black coffee, and devoured a bowl of cornflakes and fruit. 5 minutes later, he picked up his suitcase and headed for the front door. Gwyneth only ever asked him one question when he was going away: how many days? 2, he told her on this occasion, and she packed accordingly. He wouldn't even have to check before he unpacked in Berlin, because he knew everything he needed would be there. His first wife had been a whore, while his second turned out to be a virgin. Giles tried not to admit, even to himself, that he would have liked a subtle combination of both: Virginia in the bedroom and Gwyneth everywhere else. He often wondered if other men had the same fantasies. Certainly not Harry, who was even more in love with Emma than he'd been on the day they married. Giles envied that relationship, although that was something else he would never admit, even to his closest friend.
"Good morning, Alf,"
said Giles, as he climbed into the back of the car.
"Good morning, Minister,"
replied his driver cheerily. Alf had been Giles's driver since the day he'd become a minister, and he was often a better source of information about what was happening in the real world than most of his cabinet colleagues.
"So where are we off to today, sir?"
"East Berlin."
"Rather you than me."
"I know how you feel. Now, what have you got for me?"
"The election will be in June, probably the 18th.
"But the press are still predicting May. Where are you getting your information?"
"Clarence, the PM's driver, told me, didn't he?"
"Then I'll need to brief Griff immediately. Anything else?"
"The Foreign Secretary will announce this morning that he'll be standing down from the Cabinet after the election, whatever the result."
Giles didn't respond while he considered Alf's casually dropped bombshell. If he could hold on to Bristol Docklands, and if Labour were to win the general election, he must be in with a chance of being offered the Foreign Office. Only problem, 2 ifs. He allowed himself a wry smile.
"Not bad, Alf. Not bad at all,"
he added, as he opened his red box and began to look through his papers. He always enjoyed catching up with his opposite numbers across Europe, exchanging views in corridors, lifts and bars, where the Realpolitik took place, rather than in the endless formal gatherings for which civil servants had already drafted the minutes long before the meeting was called to order. Alf swept through an unmarked entrance onto runway 3 at Heathrow and came to a halt at the bottom of the boarding stairs that led up to the aircraft. If Giles didn't retain his seat in the cabinet after the election, he was going to miss all this. Back to joining baggage queues, checking counters, passport control, security checks, long walks to the gate, and then an endless wait before you were finally told you could board the plane. Alf opened the back door, and Giles climbed the steps to the waiting aircraft. "Don't get used to it," Harold Wilson had once warned him, Only the Queen can afford to do that. Giles was the last passenger to board, and the door was pulled closed as he took his seat in the front row, next to his permanent secretary.
"Good morning, Minister,"
he said. Not a man who wasted time on small talk.
"Although, on the face of it, Minister," he continued, "this conference doesn't look at all promising. There could be several opportunities for us to take advantage of."
"Such as?"
"The PM needs to know if Ulbricht is about to be replaced as General Secretary. If he is, they'll be sending out smoke signals, and we need to find out who's been chosen to replace him."
"Will it make any difference?" asked Giles. "Whoever gets the job will still be phoning reverse charges to Moscow before he can take any decisions."
"While the Foreign Secretary,"
the civil servant continued, ignoring the remark,
"is keen for you to discover if this would be a good time for the UK to make another application to join the EEC.
Has de Gaulle died and I wasn't looking?"
No, but his influence has waned since his retirement last year, and Pompidou might feel the time has come to flex his muscles.
The two men spent the rest of the flight going over the official agenda and what HMG hoped to get out of the conference, a nudge here, a wink there, whenever an understanding had been reached. When the plane taxied to a halt at Berlin's Tegel Airport, the British ambassador was waiting for them at the bottom of the steps. With the help of a police escort, the Rolls-Royce whisked them across West Berlin, but came to an abrupt halt when it reached Checkpoint Charlie, as the Western Allies had dubbed the wall's best-known crossing point. Giles looked up at the ugly, graffiti-covered wall, crowned with barbed wire. The Berlin Wall had been raised in 1961, virtually overnight, to stop the flood of people who were emigrating from east to west. East Berlin was now one giant prison, which wasn't much of an advertisement for communism. If it had really been the utopia the communists claimed, thought Giles, it would have been the West Germans who would have had to build a wall to prevent their unhappy citizens from escaping to the east.
"If I had a pickaxe," he said. "I would have to stop you," said the ambassador. "Unless, of course, you wanted to cause a diplomatic incident." "It would take more than a diplomatic incident to stop my brother-in-law fighting for what he believes in," said Giles.
Once their passports had been checked, they were able to leave the Western Sector, which allowed the driver to advance another couple of hundred yards before coming to a halt in no man's land. Giles looked up at the armed guards in their turrets, staring down grim-faced at their British guests. They remained parked between the two borders, while the Rolls-Royce was checked from the front bumper to the boot, as if it were a Sherman tank, before they were eventually permitted to enter East Berlin. But without the assistance of a police escort, it took them another hour before they reached their hotel on the other side of the city. Once they had checked in and been handed their keys, the golden rule was for the minister to swap rooms with his permanent secretary, so he wouldn't be troubled by call girls, or have to watch every word he said, because his room would certainly be bugged. But the Stasi had caught on to that ruse, and now simply bugged both rooms.
"If you want to have a private conversation," said the ambassador, "the bathroom with the taps running is the only safe place."
Giles unpacked, showered, and came back downstairs to join some Dutch and Swedish colleagues for a late lunch. Although they were old friends, it didn't stop them pumping each other for information.
"So, tell me, Giles, is Labour going to win the election?"
asked Stellan Christensen, the Swedish foreign minister.
"Officially, we can't lose. Unofficially, it's too close to call."
"And if you do win, will Mr. Wilson make you foreign secretary?"
"Unofficially, I have to be in with a chance."
"And officially?"
asked Jan Hilbert, the Dutch minister.
"I shall serve Her Majesty's government in whatever capacity the Prime Minister thinks fit."
"And I'm going to win the next Monte Carlo rally," said Hilbert.
"And I'm going back to my suite to check over my papers," said Giles,
aware that only debutantes sat around drinking just to end up spending the next day yawning. You had to be wide awake if you hoped to catch the one unguarded revelation that often made hours of negotiating worthwhile. The conference opened the following morning with a speech by the East German General Secretary, Walter Ulbricht, who welcomed the delegates. It was clear that the contents had been written in Moscow, while the words were delivered by the Soviet's puppet in East Berlin. Giles leant back, closed his eyes, and pretended to listen to the translation of a speech he'd heard several times before. But his mind soon began to wander. Suddenly, he heard an anxious voice ask,
"I hope there's nothing wrong with my translation, Sir Giles."
Giles glanced round. The Foreign Office had made it clear that, although every minister would have their own interpreter, they came with a health warning. Most of them worked for the Stasi, and any unfortunate remark or lapse in behaviour would undoubtedly be reported back to their masters in the East German Politburo. What had taken Giles by surprise was not so much the concerned inquiry made by the young woman as the fact that he could have sworn he detected a slight West Country accent.
"Your translation is just fine," he said, taking a closer look at her. "It's just that I've heard this speech, or a slight variation of it, several times before."
She was wearing a grey shapeless dress that nearly reached her ankles, and that could only have been purchased off the peg from a Comrades cooperative store. But she possessed something you couldn't buy at Harrods, luxuriant auburn hair that had been plaited and wound into a severe bun to hide any suggestion of femininity. It was as if she didn't want anyone to notice her. But her big brown eyes and captivating smile would have caused most men to take a second look, including Giles. She was like one of those ugly ducklings in a film that you know will turn out in the last scene to be a swan. It stank of a setup. Giles immediately assumed she worked for the Stasi and wondered if he could catch her out.
"You have a slight West Country burr, if I'm not mistaken," he whispered.
She nodded and displayed the same disarming smile.
"My father was born in Truro."
"Then what are you doing here?"
"I was born in East Berlin. My father met my mother when he was stationed here with the British Army in 1947. "That can't have been met with universal approval," suggested Giles. "He had to resign his commission, and he then took a job in Germany so he could be with her. A true romantic. But the story doesn't have a romantic ending, I'm afraid. More John Galsworthy than Charlotte Bronte. Because when the war went up in 1961, my father was in Cornwall visiting his parents, and we've never seen him since."
Giles remained cautious.
"That doesn't make any sense. Because if your father is a UK national, you and your mother could make an application to visit Britain at any time. We've made 34 applications in the past 9 years, and those that were answered all came back with the same red stamp, rejected."
"I'm sorry to hear that," said Giles. He then turned away, adjusted his headphones, and listened to the remainder of the welcoming speech. When the General Secretary finally sat down 1 hour and 12 minutes later, Giles was one of the few people in the room who was still awake. He left the conference chamber and joined a subcommittee to discuss the possible lifting of certain sanctions between the two countries. He had a clear brief, as did his opposite number, but during the meeting he had the distinct impression that his interpreter was including the occasional observation that came from the Stasi and not from the minister. He remained sceptical and cautious about her, although when he looked her up on the briefing notes, he saw that her name was Karen Pengelly, so it seemed she was at least telling the truth about her heritage. Giles soon became used to being followed around by Karen as he moved from meeting to meeting. She continued to pass on everything said by the other side, without the expression on her face ever changing. But Giles's responses were always carefully worded, as he still wasn't sure whose side she was on. At the end of the first day, Giles felt the conference had yielded some positive results, and not least because of his interpreter. Or was she simply saying what they wanted him to hear? During the official dinner held at the Palast der Republik, Karen sat directly behind him, translating every word of the interminable, repetitive speeches, until Giles finally weakened.
"If you write a letter to your father, I'll post it to him when I get back to England," and I'll also have a word with a colleague in the immigration office. Thank you, Sir Giles.
Giles turned his attention